Welcome, everyone, to our live webinar, 9/11, An Architect's Guide, a three-part series. Today is Wednesday, April 27th, 2022. I'm Richard Gage, AIA, member of the American Institute of Architects and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I'm also the former CEO of that organization. I'm flying solo now, independent of AE 9/11 Truth. Guess I've outgrown my nest there. It's a whole story. You can learn more about it at our new website, richardgage911.org. richardgage911.org. There's now more than 3,500 architects and engineers signed on to the petition demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. Today, we're going to find out why. Last week, we presented part two in this series, the Twin Towers' explosive destruction. This is part three, the Twin Towers and extreme heat, in which we'll be looking at the evidence of very high temperature, incendiary, and chemical reactions involved in the destruction of these two towers. Let me introduce you first to our wonderful wife and assistant and COO of Richard Gage 9/11. Ms. Gail Gage. Hello, Gail.
Hello, Richard. Hi, everybody.
And how are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderfully, and it's a beautiful day. So, yes, doing very well.
Great. And you've got a specific set of tasks to help me with today, don't you?
I do.
Let's talk about them.
Okay. Well, first we have to talk about probably one of the most exciting things coming up, which is our next conference, 9/11 Con conference. This time it is going to be about Shanksville. So we've got it. It's live streamed. And what is the exact date for that?
That might be July 16th, 2022.
Okay. So it's coming up pretty soon. So that's going to be really, really awesome because I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't know very much about the Shanksville incident for on 9/11 very well at all. I'm not very familiar with it. So I'm really excited to learn and have the experts that have been doing all the research on it share what they know about it.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. What else we got going on?
So we have some couple past podcasts. We just had John Perkins.
Confessions of an Economic Hitman?
Yes. Yes, that was awesome. It was very, I just think it's awesome that he's willing to even talk about all the things that he had to do.
Yeah.
And then coming up, we have Tom Scott Gordon and Aidan Monahan.
Tom Scott Gordon is an architectural photographer who was hired well before 9/11 2001, 10 years before, in fact, to document the replacement of the aluminum cladding on the World Trade Center towers, which was severely eroding at its connection through galvanic corrosion to the steel beyond. And it's a fascinating set of topics that he brings forth, things that he learned and saw. So relative to 9/11. And you mentioned Aidan Monahan. Aidan's done research on remote-controlled piloting technology of the aircraft on 9/11. We're really looking forward to talking to him. And coming up after him is Dwayne Dietz. You didn't even know about this one, Gail. I just talked to Dwayne today. He's done some research and found that Flight AA-77 could not have been flown by humans. In other words, it was a pre-programmed flight program installed to bring this plane to do exactly what it did, according to Dwayne and according to others who do believe that a plane hit the Pentagon. So there's a lot to unravel there. We'll do that later.
Yes, and then you had a interview done by Eddie Bravo just a couple days ago. So that was an awesome interview.
Yes. In fact, Gail, if you can help me with this, we need to get that link so that we can post a particular section of that interview, which is very relevant. It was a debate, essentially, on were there directed energy weapons involved, the work of Judy Wood. We take that on. So we'll be posting that within a few days, hopefully.
Yes. And then we have a couple of trips we're taking for speaking engagements for Richard. There's a conference down in San Diego. It's the DCG Mastermind Experience. It's a crypto conference. And that's coming up, boy, just in a couple of weeks. Yep. And that's really exciting because they're bringing in 9/11 truth to the crypto Bitcoin world.
Yeah.
And wake those guys up. Yes, about 9/11. And then after that.
And they're going to wake us up about crypto too.
Yeah, exactly. We have a lot to learn. Yeah. And then 2 weeks after that, the last weekend in May, which is Memorial Weekend, we're going down to San Antonio, Texas for the Advanced Medicine Conference. That's Dr. Rashid Batar's conference.
We're going to speak to 1,000 doctors about 9/11. It's a case study in manipulation at an incredible level from government and media and across the world, NATO. This subject, as you'll see today in the evidence, discloses the extent of a huge megalithic problem in our society where we can be so manipulated to go to war. What we're going to drill down into the specific evidence of the destruction of the Twin Towers today, but they want to hear this. We've been invited and we're being flown to San Antonio to speak to 1,000 doctors. Now, that's the kind of exposure we need to get out of the echo chamber of the 9/11 truth movement. And we're going to learn a lot too there, aren't we, Gail?
Yes, we are very much looking forward to that. Yes.
And we just learned today, Gail, that we have a tabling opportunity there from Wendy with Dr. Rashid Batar, who's sponsoring this whole thing. So we got to prepare for that.
Yes, we do. Oh, that's good news. Yeah. And this is part three of the webinar series. So we will be taking a week off. So there will be no webinar next week. And then we'll pick it back up with part one on May 11th, if everything goes correctly.
Absolutely correct. Now, regarding questions for today's webinar, how does that work?
Yes. So whatever platform you're on, it looks like LinkedIn and Twitter, you should be able to ask questions in the comments under the videos, just like YouTube and Facebook. And we are back on YouTube. I see comments coming in already from that platform. So put your questions in the comments and I will copy and paste them over for Richard and he can answer them at the very end of the webinar.
All right. Well, this is great. Oh, that's funny. I just posted a note. There's a few questions from Simon Thornycraft, and
I saw that
he's a debunker, and I meant to give you a private message, but now that I have made it public, we'll go ahead and answer those questions because he's just been a thorn in my side, no pun intended, for quite a while. So now, is there any other questions before you answer the door there?
No.
There is a doorbell, so you're going to need to get that. We'll let Gail go do her job and we'll get on with the bye. See you later. Let's see. Thrown for a loop there. Let's tell you a few other things because some people don't realize that we're going to share our screen here. There it is. I found it. Here, there. Some people don't realize that we are indeed unleashed at Richard Gage 9/11. We have a podcast. We just told you many of the upcoming and previous exciting podcasts. There's about 30 of them, though, on our website. As far as me, there's a few things you should know, I guess, about my background. I was responsible at a local firm here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, I'm now in Idaho, but I was there, and I was responsible for the construction documents for these $3 and $10 million gymnasiums. and the construction administration for this $125 million high school. More recently, before launching full-time into this important outreach effort of 9/11 Truth, I had similar responsibilities working on the $400 million mixed-use project near Las Vegas with six blocks of retail, mid-rise office space, and parking structure, altogether about 1,200 tons of fireproof steel framing. I now work full-time educating architects, engineers, and others to understand what happened at the World Trade Center using the materials in these courses. So, with that in mind, let's jump right into it, because we do have 3,500 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation. And we're going to find out why today. One reason is we use the scientific method in contrast to NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain these collapses to the American people. And we're going to be exposing yet more of the fraud in this part three, as we did in part two and part one of this series, starting with World Trade Center 7 and beginning with today, the extreme heat. So we formulate a question, right? This is the scientific method. We've had it in the West for 100 years or so. How do we move it through the scientific method? We do so objectively. The question here is, what caused the towers to collapse? We perform some research, make some observations. Well, other towers collapse, for instance? That's something we can do, some background research, construct hypothesis, make predictions. Maybe the planes brought them down. Maybe it was fire. Maybe it was explosions. We'll be showing a lot of evidence last week, and particularly this week, of extreme heat. And maybe, therefore, it was controlled demolition. Well, we lay out all the hypotheses. We don't focus on any one of them due to our own subjective issues, such as our political and our financial obligations that might sway our objective opinion in the matter. So we test these with experiments, we analyze the results, we draw conclusions. If the hypothesis is corroborated, we report the results in an open, transparent manner. If the hypothesis is not corroborated, we go back, we try again, and we construct a new hypothesis and make new predictions until we have a hypothesis that is corroborated per the experiments, the results, the analysis, the observations, etc. So we're going to do that, going back to some background research. What are the forces that have destroyed buildings? Fire has certainly been a destructive force, never brought down a high-rise, as we'll see, a steel frame fire-protected high-rise. But it's, say, in wood frame buildings. This is an organic, chaotic process, burns out an area in roughly 20 minutes or so. Moving on, looking for fresh new fuel sources after that. Now, this is even acknowledged by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who says such fires did not persist in any one location for more than about 20 or 30 minutes. And so we find that that's actually true. The fires move on. Well, we saw in recent, in our part one and part two of this series, that NIST shows these fires remaining in Building 7, particularly, for more than an hour in the same place, so that they can develop their collapse initiation hypothesis around column 79, which has been proven to be fraudulent, the extent and the location and the duration of those fires. So, Cardington, UK, Simon had a question about this. Yes, this is an eight-story building fire test in 1995. They had steel that was not fireproofed. They had steel that was fireproofed, and they had incredible fuel sources, as you can see here, very unusual fuel sources that were trying to develop the hottest fires that they could. And in this test, we're going to look at it very carefully. But this is a extremely important test, particularly relevant to the Building 7 case study. And what happens in the test? Let's take a look.
This was the largest test of its kind ever conducted. It showed how unprotected steel can be distorted, even by a normal office fire. But as is typical in steel buildings, the structural beams only slowly and progressively warped and sagged. There was no chance of a sudden collapse.
In over 20 years, I have not seen, until recently, a protected steel structure that has collapsed in a fire.
Until recently. Of course, he's referring here to 9/11, when we had not two, but three protected steel structures collapse due to fire. But as you notice, even the executive summary says this is an inherently stable behavior due to the highly redundant nature of the structural steel form. Yes, the unprotected steel frame, which in Building 7 we had none, even though NIST removed the fire protection from the steel beams in their computer model, fraudulently so, the connections here don't fail. Even in unprotected steel, it's the strongest part of the system. And yet that's what was claimed to have failed in Building 7. Twin Towers, slightly different story. It's a very different story, actually. We'll get to that. So let's look at some buildings that were destroyed. We have these buildings exploded. We have thick, billowing, enormous pyroclastic-like clouds expanding rapidly in cauliflower-shaped forms due to the incredible heat from the gases of the ignition of the explosives. We have pyroclastic-like clouds that are seen by witnesses. Not only that, but sounds of explosions heard by witnesses and flashes of light seen by them. If you have these features, you know you have explosions. Now, we'll get to the fact that NIST disacknowledges these, denies these features. So now we have controlled demolitions in this country where you can take explosives and place them at key locations through at the columns and beams throughout the building and then detonate them in a very precise order. And so what you get is something like this. There's only a handful of companies in the United States can even accomplish this. It doesn't happen by itself. It doesn't happen by fires or jet planes striking buildings either. This is a set of processes that we have to look at as precedents, as you'll see. So that's important. So there's a set of features that are associated with controlled demolition. One of them is there's a sudden onset of destruction, usually at the base of the structure, but not always. It can be anywhere they want, as we will see. And we have, including at the point of jet plane impacts, we have straight down symmetrical collapse into the building's footprint, typically, if that's what they want to accomplish, because there's a patterned removal of column supports. There's a results in a free fall or near free fall acceleration straight down through the path of greatest resistance. The total dismemberment of the structural steel frame, limited damage to adjacent structures, there's patterned explosions and flashes of light heard and seen by witnesses, broken up concrete floors. You don't want to have to go back and jackhammer those floors at all odd angles in controlled demolition. That's very dangerous work. There's also isolated explosive ejections called squibs, which are readily seen And so, oops, we have chemical evidence of explosive devices left behind also. So let me just catch that one. I need to correct some of these slides. So we have direct evidence of destruction with explosives is what we have here. Not evidence of destruction by fire. In fact, there's no evidence of destruction by fire in a controlled demolition. Fire doesn't cause these features, any of them, let alone all of them. Fires cause structures to collapse asymmetrically with gradual deformation following the path of least resistance. So, experts said, oh gosh, we've never had a modern steel reinforced protected structure collapse due to uncontrolled fire. Why all of a sudden do we have three? Well, one reason is steel conducts that heat away from the source. It's very dense material. So the conduction is rapid. It never gets to, or rarely gets to, its 1200 degree Fahrenheit temperature when steel can begin to sag when it loses half of its strength. We don't want that to happen. So we keep that from happening by applying cementitious material, 2 hours on the beams, 3 hours on the columns. Guess what? That's 4 to 6 times as much protection as the building needs, even according to NIST, which says that there's a fire in an area only 20 to 30 minutes. That's all the fuel there is to burn in that area. So it moves on, again, looking for fresh new fuel sources. We also keep the tenants from bringing in the large fuel loads. We regulate what their office furnishings can be built out of, for instance. We also keep the contractors from building the buildings out of combustible materials. So in case all that's not enough, we also sprinkler our high-rise buildings to keep them extra safe. In the case of the Twin Towers, the sprinklers were said to have been damaged by the impact of the planes. And so we don't need to discuss that, because what we're looking at today is the evidence of explosive and incendiary demolition. And that's really important. So with that in mind, we can also look at circumstantial corroborative evidence, such as government documentation. That's can be very helpful when we have it. Foreknowledge of the destruction. People know in advance when a controlled demolition is happening, like we looked at, particularly with regard to Building 7 in this series. Experts agreeing, yeah, that's a controlled demolition. Well, at least those experts, without financial or political obligations that might sway their objective opinion in with regard to whether a building's brought down by controlled demolition or not. With video documentation, all that can be proof of controlled demolition. A body of proof we're going to apply now to the Twin Towers, beginning with, whoops, let's fix this one too. I replaced all these and then got some alignment issues. Is there... in fact, we looked at this series last week, this series of features 1 through 8. And we found in last week's webinar that we do indeed have these first 8 key characteristic features of explosive demolition in the Twin Towers. Sudden onset of destruction, explosions and flashes of light heard and seen by witnesses, straight down symmetrical progression outside the footprint, isolated explosive ejections, near free fall acceleration, total shattering of the steel and figure 7. Item 7, lateral ejection of structural steel at 80 miles an hour, landing 600 feet in all directions, and the pulverized concrete. All of that, if you missed it, be sure to go back and look at that particular webinar. We didn't need that one, so we will eliminate that one altogether. And we just isolated these ones, these features. And so that's all direct evidence of destruction with explosives. So fire doesn't explain that. Today, we're going to be looking first at the pyroclastic-like clouds of pulverized concrete, emphasizing the heat, pyroclastic-like. That comes from the term volcano, with extremely hot solid objects exceeding 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, for instance. Well, the National Fire Protection Association Guide 921 for Fire and Explosion Investigations is the accepted authority on this. And NIST actually helped to develop some of these guides. So they should be quite aware of them and follow them inherently. Well, there's thermal effects that they say to look for. What? Yeah, look for the large volumes of gas, large amount of heat released in chemical explosions, causing rapidly expanding plumes of hot gases. Well, that's exactly what we have emanating from the destruction of the Twin Towers in all the photos and all the videos right in front of our eyes. There's a whole lot of heat here, expanding these clouds 10 times the volume of the building in just 30 seconds. And that is not caused by the few fires that we see in the towers at the time of the collapse, which are diminished, of course, as you can even see and indicated by the thick black smoke. These are oxygen starved and thus very cool fires, relatively cool, 250 to 500 degrees Fahrenheit at the max. But all of that smoke, all of that incredible gaseous clouds are indicative of the of something far hotter, something like this, something which we do find in the towers, because those fires were surely extinguished by the mechanical action of the collapsing building. So where's all that heat coming from? Let's take a look. Feature number 9. Let's jump into Massimo Mazzucco's 9/11 New Pearl Harbor.
Possibly the most important unexplained phenomenon at Ground Zero are the extremely high temperatures registered under the rubble for many weeks after the collapses. On September 16, NASA shot these thermographic images of Ground Zero, indicating unusually high temperatures at the base of the three collapsed buildings. Despite the heavy rains of September 14th, the hotspots registered peak temperatures of more than 1,300 degrees under the rubble. 10 days later, the fires kept burning.
What's to explain, Governor, the smoke that still comes out?
There's still fire down below. There is such an incredibly deep pile of rubble, and the tower goes down 5-6 stories underground.
We had ABC crews come back just in the last few minutes and telling us there are still flames coming out of the base of the Trade Towers.
For the rescue workers, this became an additional burden on their already gruesome task.
Out, still on the rubble, it's still, I believe, 1,100 degrees. The guy's boots just melt within a few hours.
On October 8th, the hotspots under the three collapsed buildings remained clearly visible. 6 weeks later, as the excavations progressed, the situation seemed only to get worse.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And this is 6 weeks later, almost 6 weeks later. And as we get closer to the center of this, it gets hotter and hotter. It's probably 1,500 degrees. We've had some small windows into what we thought was a core at some point, and it looked like an oven. You know, it was just roaring inside. And it's just a bright, bright reddish-orange color.
The consequences of such extreme temperatures were quite visible on the steel that was being extracted from the rubble.
Where the grapplers were pulling stuff out, big sections of iron that were literally on fire on the other end. They would hit the air and burst into flames, which was pretty spooky to see.
You would create an air pocket by moving steel, fueling the fire underground. But, you know, these underground fires were just like the fires of hell.
If you could make a video of what you perceive hell to look like, from fire shooting up at times, that's what would happen. You would be in the middle of what would look like steel, and then fire just would pop up. Firemen were coming out with, and iron workers with their boots literally melted. And then the hose would come over and they would try to put that part out.
I got there.
Charlie Vitchers was a supervisor of removal operations at Ground Zero. From PBS's America Rebuilds page, we read, Vitcher's crew picked up 40 to 60 foot long pieces of steel impaled in the pile, where the bottom 20 feet would be glowing red hot. Vitcher said, trucks loaded with steel would pass by and you could feel the back of your neck burning standing 20 feet away. In an article called A Dangerous Worksite, the U.S. Department of Labor wrote, underground fires burned at temperatures of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. This was confirmed by Mayor Giuliani.
There were fires of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit below the ground.
The Journal of the American Society of Safety Engineers wrote, thermal measurements taken by helicopter each day showed underground temperatures ranging from 400 to more than 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. 8 weeks later, and the fires still had not subsided.
You see how this debris is still smoking? That's when the fire is going to still burn. 8 weeks later, we still got fires burning. So, I mean, these things are burning. At one point, I think they were about 2,800 degrees.
11 weeks later, and the fires kept burning.
As recently as the end of November, it was still 1,100 degrees down underneath the rubble.
As November turned into December, ice was noticed in the mornings above the ground, but the debris underneath was still smoldering.
The weird thing was it was very cold when we were up there. I believe it was in the middle of the winter, but the ground wasn't frozen. The ground kind of like bubbled underneath your feet, which was kind of strange to me.
It took until December 19, more than 3 months after the collapses, for the last underground fire to be extinguished.
Pretty incredible. And we've got red-hot steel being pulled from deep within the pile weeks after the collapse, says David Scott, formerly of Arup Associates. Dripping from the molten steel, says this firefighter, saw pools of literally molten steel, says the president of the cleanup company. Seeing the molten steel, uncovering red-hot metal beams, ranging from molten metal, which was still red-hot weeks after the event. Why are we looking at all this evidence? We're looking at it because the official narrative with normal office fires and jet fuel cannot possibly account for even a quarter or a half of the temperatures that are documented again and again and again. The molten steel at the heart of the towers remains. Streams of molten metal that leaked from hot cores and flowed down. Metal dripping from a beam. Molten steel beams. The end of the beam would be dripping molten steel. Mark Loiseau, president of one of the cleanup companies and president of Controlled Demolition, Inc., interestingly. Molten steel was encountered primarily during the excavation of debris. Videotapes and photos of the molten steel being dipped out by the buckets of the excavators, as you see here. What can account for this incredible heat? It has to be answered, that question. It's ground zero of any debate with any debunker or skeptic. A river of steel flowing, says who? The World Trade Center structural engineer himself, Leslie Robertson, and his associate, Richard Garlock. The debris past the columns was red hot, molten, running. You can't deny this evidence. You can't ignore it. Especially when it's flowing out of the South Tower minutes prior to its collapse. Molten iron, as it turns out. Molten steel. It's not molten aluminum. Why? NIST claimed, oh, that must have been melted airplane. But molten aluminum is, in daylight conditions, silvery. Guess what? Concrete melted. This has to be acknowledged. They try to pretend that all of this doesn't exist, and they focus on pieces of evidence that they think they can account for. And even that doesn't work. But here's concrete. I didn't even know concrete could melt. 3,200 degrees Fahrenheit it takes to melt concrete. How did the concrete melt? It's in the police museum. Fire temperatures so intense that concrete melted like lava around everything in its path, including this handgun from the police department located in World Trade Center 6. Steel members in the debris pile that appeared to have been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures, says who? The FEMA author himself, Jonathan Barnett. There's a problem here. It takes 4,000 degrees to evaporate steel. How do you get 4,000 degree temperatures? You can't answer that question. You can ignore it, but you look pretty bad ignoring it. This gentleman tried to ignore it, Abulhazen Astani Azal, a structural engineer from UC Berkeley, who's here looking at what he said was the melting of girders. He assumed they melted down in the pile, not realizing that evidence to the contrary is all over the place. The pile doesn't get hot enough by some magical process, as we'll see, to melt girders somehow. He says, if you remember the Salvador Dali paintings with the clocks that are kind of melted, it's kind of like that. That could only happen if you get steel yellow hot or white hot, perhaps around 2,000 degrees. So he knows the temperature capable of this, but he doesn't know how it happened. And he denies that it happened by controlled demolition or incendiaries. But we'll be showing you a lot of evidence for just that. Let's go back to Massimo Mazzucco's 9/11 New Pearl Harbor.
Another proof of extremely high temperatures reached during the collapse are the twisted and mangled steel beams found at Ground Zero.
Architects, engineers, people who work with steel, welders have just never seen the level of destruction and the level of deformation of this material in our lives.
You saw steel, some of the thickest steel I've ever seen, bent like a pretzel.
This 8-ton steel I-beam is 6 inches thick. It was selected to be preserved for future generations for the near-perfect horseshoe-like bend formed during the collapse.
I found it hard to believe that it actually bent because of the size of it and how there's no cracks in the iron. It bent without almost a single crack in it. It takes thousands of degrees to bend steel like this.
In fact, the temperature of 2,800 degrees mentioned before is not casual at all, as that's exactly the temperature at which steel melts.
So how are those temperatures realized at the World Trade Center? Hang on one second. We're going to get back to you. Well, FEMA gives us a clue. It's in their Appendix C in the May of 2002 Building Performance Assessment Team report. What do they say in this metallurgical examination of the World Trade Center steel? A 1-inch column reduced to 1/2-inch thickness, its edges curled like a paper scroll, thinned to almost razor sharpness. This can't be explained away. There it is, right in front of our faces. What else do they say about this? Rapid oxidation, sulfidation, intergranular melting, liquid iron. Guess what? That's molten iron. Guess what? That's 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit minimum to melt iron. Explain where this is coming from. They call it a hot sulfur attack on the steel. Where did this sulfur come from? Why are they calling it an attack on the steel? This is very revealing. Perhaps the greatest mystery uncovered in the investigation, says the New York Times, but it's completely omitted from the NIST report. They threw it out when they took over the investigation in 2002 from FEMA. the entire metallurgical examination. Was that relevant evidence? Yeah. The presence of sulfur, iron sulfide. NIST was asked this question a lot of times in their very frequently asked questions, which they finally posted on their website. Sulfur is present in the gypsum wallboard that was prevalent in the interior partitions. What? Gypsum board? Excuse me? Gypsum wallboard contains inert calcium sulfate. It doesn't get released and attack the steel that for 100 years it's been designed to protect. This is the kind of fraud that NIST comes up with to try to explain away the obvious evidence. Well, you can do experiments in your own backyard like John Cole's civil engineer did. He got the hottest fires he could possibly muster with gypsum wallboard crushed and put against the steel. Was there any hot sulfur corrosion attack? No. Experiment is the arbiter of competing hypotheses. John Field says the smell of sulfur, it burned. That smell, it permeated everything. Could never block out that smell. It haunted me. The sulfur burning. And John Gross, co-project leader of the NIST report, what does he say about this phenomena of molten materials?
First of all, let's go back to your basic premise that there was a pool of molten steel. I know of absolutely nobody, no eyewitness who said so, nobody who's produced it.
But witnesses testify otherwise.
You'd get down below and you'd see molten steel. Molten steel running down the channel rails. Like you're in a foundry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like lava.
Like lava. Actually melted beams where it was molten steel that was being dug out.
Underground, it was still so hot that molten metal dripped down the sides of a wall.
And the cleanup was very difficult in the beginning. Steel was coming out red in certain areas from the first couple
of
weeks.
This fused element of steel, molten steel.
A river of steel flowing, says the World Trade Center structural engineer himself. But here's John Gross identifying the very end of the beam on the pile that was used in the metallurgical examination by FEMA, which NIST, led by John Gross and Shyam Sunder, threw out the entire examination. This is, he denies it, but his shadow is all over the evidence. So how do you get temperatures exceeding 2,800 degrees? Hydrocarbons only burn at 600 to 1,400 degrees, typically. Jet fuel, per its own manufacturer, ME Petroleum, burns in open air only at about 600 degrees maximum. So there's a quarter of the temperature that's documented again and again and again. Answer the question. If it's not jet fuel and it's not open office fires, what is it? Because steel and iron had definitely melted during the event. And we can tell by the color of the molten steel and iron what its temperature is. Here we're exceeding with the bright yellow and even white hot temperatures, 2,500 degrees minimum Fahrenheit. Where's it coming from? And what caused it to melt? In a very frequently set of asked questions of NIST, they write, finally, any molten steel in the wreckage was more likely due to the high temperature resulting from long exposure to combustion within the pile rather than short exposure to fires or explosions while the buildings were standing. What? There's a law. It's called the conservation of energy. In a closed system, such as fires burning under pulverized concrete, powder, and water in the basements of the World Trade Center. The amount of energy is fixed. You can't create any more energy inside the system. The fire can't somehow get hotter than the capacity of the fuel that it's burning. This is obvious to a seventh grader. You can only convert the energy you have from one form to another. In other words, in this case, the heat is dissipated. It's not increased. Well, what could be responsible? Could thermite have produced all that molten metal? Well, what is thermite anyway?
An incendiary used by the military, thermite is a compound of iron oxide and aluminum, which when ignited, sustains an extreme heat reaction, creating molten iron. In just 2 seconds, thermite can reach temperatures over 4,500 degrees Fahrenheit, quite enough to liquefy steel. We know that open-air fires cannot burn hot enough to melt steel, but metal had melted at the base of the towers. Appendix C of the FEMA report describes sulfur residues on the World Trade Center steel. The New York Times called this the deepest mystery of all. Sulfur slightly lowers the melting point of iron, and iron oxide and iron sulfide had formed on the surface of the structural steel. Sulfur used with thermite is called thermate, producing even faster results.
Wait a minute. Maybe we're getting somewhere here. Because if thermite were used, it would explain the extremely hot temperatures that jet fuel and office fires cannot possibly explain. It would explain the presence of sulfur, because sulfur is added to thermite to become thermate, much more effective at cutting through thicker sections of steel. It would also explain the presence of liquid molten iron, which is the byproduct of thermite. And which we're going to see a whole lot more evidence of in a moment. Was the investigative guidelines of NFPA 921 even followed? Because they say, look for unusual residues that could arise from thermite, magnesium, or other pyrotechnic materials. This says, we found no corroborating evidence to suggest that explosives were used. Well, a year later, they finally admit that they never tested for the presence of explosive residue. How sincere is their original claim then? You won't find what you won't look for. Well, others looked for it. Guess what? It wasn't that hard to find. Stephen Jones, a physicist formerly from Brigham Young University, does some research. Imagine that. Background research. What could create these kind of temperatures? He finds thermite. Well, it produces a characteristic burn pattern, a white, yellow, hot liquid metal, like we see pouring out of the South Tower minutes prior to its collapse and dripping out of the buckets of the excavators. He says also, though, look for a whitish cloud of aluminum oxide ash, like we see rising out of the top of this material, pouring out of the South Tower minutes prior to its collapse. And like we see from every single one of these freely flying structural steel sections ejected out of the towers laterally at 80 miles an hour, as we saw last week, landing 600 feet in every direction, back to forward two. That is a freely flying section. Why is it on fire? Steel is not combustible at temperatures associated with jet fuel or office fires. What is going on with the ends of these steel columns? Looks more like a volcanic eruption in the Tongan Sea, with upward, outward arching solid objects ejected in a geometry of fireworks. doesn't even look like a building collapse. Think about it, people. Both of these towers were nearly identical in design. They were identical except for the antenna on the top. Both of them had identical failures with upward, outward arching streamers. Freely flying columns trailed by thick white smoke clouds.
Where the grapplers were pulling stuff out, big sections of iron that were literally on fire on the other end. They would hit the air and burst into flames.
Sections of steel columns on fire. That doesn't happen with jet fuel. That doesn't happen with normal office fires. Let's go back to thermite. It would leave behind a unique chemical evidence, says Stephen Jones. Common elements such as iron, aluminum, copper, calcium, silicon, but more unusual elements such as fluorine and manganese left behind in the residue. These elements in the periodic table of the elements. Well, somebody sent Stephen Jones a chunk, a piece of this 40-pound chunk of molten metal from a meteorite. They called them meteorites because that's how they described them. They'd never seen molten iron in office fires. So he does some tests on it. Electron microprobe data finds that it's predominantly iron. It's not steel. It's not aluminum from the jet planes. Okay, strike that off of our list. It has abundant manganese, so we can rule out molten structural steel as a major component as well. It has aluminum, sulfur, and potassium. Clearly the residue of thermite, an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. But that's not all. It has manganese and fluorine in abundance. What does that mean? Manganese is from the potassium permanganate, commonly used as an oxidizer in thermite. Fluorine is used in Sol-Gel-type thermite charges. So these are often present in the WTC steel residue and are part of a thermite fingerprint. This has to be investigated. There are sculptures all around the world still with this residue on them. Though 99% of the evidence of, in the form of steel columns and beams suffered a fate that we'll get to, there is still lots of evidence. He also says Sol gels would leave a very special residue. What would that be? 1,3-diphenylpropane. What the heck is that? One molecule was present at levels that dwarfed all others. 1,3-diphenylpropane per the EPA. He says, Eric Schwartz, we've never observed it in any other sampling we've done. They've done samplings in fires. They know there's plastic in and computer parts in fires. But we've never observed it in any other sampling we've done. They don't know why it would be there. They only speculate. The Peace Park in Manitoba, a piece of slag from that particular sculpture is sent to Stephen Jones. He does X-ray fluorescence analysis. What does he find? Iron, sulfur, aluminum, manganese, the ingredients of thermite with added sulfur becoming thermate. Why is that found? This is the evidence of thermite also. And we're only just getting started here. All of this evidence piece by piece, has to be explained by the debunkers. Not ignored, not overlooked, not sidestepped, all of it. You can cut steel with thermite and even thermate in your own backyard. John Cole, civil engineer, did that too. Here's the results.
It was reduced in thickness with gaping holes, thinned to almost razor sharpness with a Swiss cheese appearance.
Wait a minute. Where did we see that before? Oh, in the Appendix C that NIST threw out of their report that FEMA had included in the 2002 FEMA report. All of this has to be explained. There were devices invented and used prior to 2001 that issue streams of molten iron in hundreds of milliseconds, cutting through much thicker slabs of steel than normal controlled demolition high energy explosive charges like C4 and RDX can do. This technology was available. It used thermite. This isn't some manufactured technology by conspiracy theorists. In fact, there are some devices whose casings themselves are made of consumable consolidated thermite. So there's nothing left behind but pools of molten iron, which are documented at the World Trade Center. But what else was found in the fine powder so ubiquitous on 9/11 in a 3-square-mile area across lower Manhattan, 3 inches thick? The U.S. Geological Survey does studies on this dust. In 2005, they produced a report. It's very important because what they found was molten iron microspheres, previously molten, billions of them, up to 4 tons of them by extrapolation. They document that they're elemental iron. That's the byproduct of thermite. It's not aluminum. Up to 6% of some of these samples were composed of these molten, previously molten iron microspheres. They don't know where they came from. They don't even speculate. It's not common office building dust, as you see on the left, but they're spherical. And there's 150 times more than what you see on the left. So R.J. Lee Group, an environmental consulting firm, very well known, does studies as well on the dust. They say, well, gosh, we don't know where these came from, but they're formed during the event, not before, by the welders putting the buildings together, not afterward by the iron workers taking it apart, but during the event. They're used as a signature component by the EPA to distinguish World Trade Center dust from common office building dust. In other words, it's not even World Trade Center dust unless it has these billions of previously molten iron microspheres in it. And we don't know where they came from. Well, where do they come from? Here's a controlled experiment with just a little bit of thermite ignited and produces what looks like thousands and thousands of sparks, but what is in essence liquid molten iron microspheres that cool and fall into the pan. because when you aerosolize liquid, it becomes spherical by its surface tension. That's just what it does. So under explosive conditions, liquid molten iron would also become spherical. Is that what could explain the toasting of the tops of all of these cars around the World Trade Center in this very high heat event that some like to call a no heat event for some reason, despite all the evidence you've just seen? What other rational explanation for there is from the debunking community that tries to wave off all this evidence with their magic wand, but they have to ignore 99% of it, trying to choose those pieces that they believe they can answer and wave away, which I'm sure we'll be dealing with shortly. But what else was found in all the World Trade Center dust? A team of eight international scientists, led by Niels Harrod in Copenhagen, is sent, independently collected by citizens who heard about their work, seven dust samples, like the one from this apartment of Jeanette McKinley's, because all of their windows blew in from the tremendous explosive event that we documented last week, 2 weeks ago, I think, now on this three-part webinar series, 9/11, An Architect's Guide. Jeanette McKinley suffered, as they all did, and she used the dust in her artwork as an artist to try to heal some of the trauma. Unfortunately, she developed brain cancer due to her association with it, not realizing the danger. It's a very tragic situation, as the whole thing, of course, was very, very tragic for so many victims, 3,000 victims. Roughly. Well, what was found in all these dust samples? Red-gray chips. They look like paint. They're red on one side, gray on the other. Obviously, fluid applied like paint. Unlike paint, they're attracted to a magnet. They have a high iron content. So what they discovered, as if they didn't know. Interestingly, hold on. They get real curious then, right? What's in this stuff? They do X-ray energy dispersive spectroscopy and find what? Iron content and aluminum content. Iron and aluminum. What is that? That is the ingredient of thermite. This is not the ingredients of paint. They get real curious. What's it doing there? Iron, that's elemental iron, by the way. Iron oxide, which is essentially rust. And they go into the analysis with a nuclear microscope capable of giving them 50,000 times a peek into this material. What do they find? Nano-sized particles of iron oxide. Crystals, 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. What else do they find? Aluminum platelets, again at the nano scale. This is not paint. They're set in an organic matrix with oxygen, silica, carbon. Organic material is what is provides the incredible expansion due to that TNT uses organic material to expand, knock things over. So this is very interesting. You have an incendiary thermite that appears to have been engineered to become more explosive. Its properties are documented by Lawrence Livermore Lab, Los Alamos Lab, before 9/11, at about 420 degrees Celsius, about 758 Fahrenheit, they ignite. Well, that's exactly what the chips do. And that's called super thermite, by the way, that they identified. The particular four chips that they very carefully documented ignite at about the same temperature, each of the chips, producing a whole lot of energy, identifying it as a thermitic reaction. Paint doesn't do that. Paint doesn't do this either, because when it ignites, it produces what? Molten iron microspheres with the same chemical signature as the molten iron microspheres have in the World Trade Center dust samples documented by R.J. Lee and the U.S. Geological Survey. So you see, we know where these came from. These molten iron microspheres came from these red-gray chips. As if we didn't know, they're found attached to partially ignited red-gray chips, as you see here and here. So you see, this is a repeatable set of corroborative experimental data that, as documented, could put a lot of people away for mass murder and treason in the crime of the century. And that's what we're making this evidence available for to the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, lc4911.org, who's packaged 60 exhibits and submitted it to the U.S. Attorney in Manhattan for a special grand jury investigation. We'll come back to that. You see, when you get these particles so small, their surface volume increases exponentially, and you have an almost instantaneous chemical reaction, engineering an incendiary to become more explosive. It's not made in a cave in Afghanistan. This is made only in the most advanced defense contracting laboratories, whose source can be pinpointed in any kind of a real investigation by any kind of a courageous journalist who wants to step out beyond the prescribed confines that their employers establish for them. So we do have a coherent, non-contradictory collapse model for the World Trade Center towers. It requires these three kinds of energetic materials: explosives. That's how we get the freely flying structural steel sections, thermite, and nanothermite. Don't know exactly how they work in the World Trade Center towers. We know how they work. They work by means of heat, incendiaries. And of course, the explosives work by means of gas, propellants draw between the draw from phenomena in between those two ends of the spectrum. It's all documented in the 2009 Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal. The red layer is unreacted thermitic material incorporating nanotechnology and its highly energetic pyrotechnic or explosive material. They're playing it very safe here with the wording. No matter how the wording is established, the results are clear that this material should not have been found in all the World Trade Center dust samples, and there are lots of dust samples left to examine. in a real, unimpeachable investigation. So what we've found today is that this is direct evidence of destruction with explosives and incendiaries, particularly today. Fire doesn't create any one of these features, fire being the official cause of the collapse, according to NIST. It's a fabrication. It's a complete fraud perpetrated on the American people and the people of the world in a $6.5 trillion global war on terror, which has been stolen from the American people in particular, creating a surveillance state where our emails, our phone calls are automatically recorded in complete violation of the Constitution of the United States. And we accept it because we've traded in our freedom for security. And we got neither. Even the thermal imaging videos show that these temperatures in the World Trade Center towers immediately prior to the collapse were very low. In this case, under 200 degrees Fahrenheit, maximum 500 degrees Fahrenheit. No explanation of how you get 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit temperatures out of that. Let's listen to the experts. Some of them are not fouled by their financial or political objectives. There's 100 structural engineers signed on to the petition demanding a new investigation among the 3,500. One of them is Ronald Brookman. He says, doesn't even look like a heat-induced gravitational collapse mechanism. Why did the complete collapse of the Twin Towers become inevitable, as claimed by NIST? Why would all 110 stories drop straight down to the ground in 10, maybe 15 seconds, pulverizing the contents to dust and twisted steel? Ed Muniak, fire protection engineer, the fires were very weak. The NIST reports confirm that the fire temperatures were low. World Trade Center collapses have no resemblance to any previous high-rise fire collapse. Not that there's been any in a steel frame fireproofed high rise. What about the evidence left behind in the form of the steel? Surely the evidence was preserved in easily the three largest structural failures in history. Well, let's listen to one of the structural engineers who was tasked with analyzing that forensic evidence. Abulhasan Astani Azal, structural engineer at Berkeley.
After 9/11, we realized that Port Authority of New York and New Jersey has sent all the steel that we need to study. That's why I'm here to study steel. Has sent all the steel to recycling plant to go to China for recycling. For what? For 15 cents a pound. Just nothing. And all the evidence of steel went to melting pot.
All the evidence of the steel went to the melting pot, to China for recycling. Why was it not preserved like when we have an airplane disaster where the airplane is recreated, its pieces in the hangar, for instance? Well, Mike Bloomberg, New York mayor, following Giuliani, he says, just looking at a piece of metal generally doesn't tell you anything. He's referring to complaints about the steel being taken away, recycled for 15 cents a pound. He has an engineering degree. He knows better than this. The fraud is extended again and again, giving voice to Bill Manning, editor-in-chief of Fire Engineering Magazine, who cries out crucial evidence that can answer many questions, is on the slow boat to China, showing an astounding ignorance of government officials to the value of a thorough scientific investigation. The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately. But it doesn't. We have 400 truckloads per day carted away, starting just 2 weeks after 9/11. This is the illegal destruction of evidence in a crime scene. But guess what? They declared it an act of war. So they weren't bound by the measures required of them to protect the evidence in a crime scene. So what have we shown today? What brought down the towers? Was it the planes, the ensuing fires, or was it explosions and controlled demolitions? We want to hear from you. We want to know what you think. What we believe we've shown is the 10 key characteristic features of controlled demolitions, 3 today in features 8, 9, and 10, and some very uncharacteristic features as well. 7 of them yesterday, 2 weeks ago. Altogether, 10 characteristic and uncharacteristic features of controlled demolition. This is not direct evidence of fire destruction, but direct evidence of explosive and incendiary destruction. With additional circumstantial corroborative testimony, we believe this is proof of controlled demolition with incendiaries and high-energy explosives, proof that has convinced more than 3,500 architects and engineers who have had the courage to actually look at the evidence to be convinced. Virtually everyone who actually looks at the evidence that we're presenting comes away convinced. At least those with technical degrees like architects, engineers, physicists, and so forth. There are some people that, for whatever reason, can't see the evidence or won't. And I believe we're going to be talking or answering some questions from at least one of them today. So it should be very interesting. So while you're putting your questions together, I want you to take a moment to get on my email list at richardgage911.org so that we can continue to bring you the evidence, to bring you the efforts we're making toward getting a real investigation. And I don't know why anyone would object to a real investigation that answers the hundreds of questions that we brought up in this three-part seminar, unless they have a motive that is not sincere. We want you to get informed. We have the evidence right on our website at richardgage911.org. We have the brochures that you can obtain. You can give them out one-on-one. The outline of evidence that we presented in this three-part series is almost all right here. We also have another brochure that is helpful in understanding the larger context in which 9/11 sits, the manipulation of world events, particularly by the Project for a New American Century, a neoconservative think tank that had war on its mind when it called for regional hegemony in the Middle East, a vast increase in the budget of the Pentagon, and which benefits what and who? Bankers, the arms industry, etc. Regarding the technical evidence, you can find it in our documentaries here on our website in the videos section. Presentations also, interviews also, street activism that we've done for the last 15 years. We've been on this. There's a petition you can sign over at AE911 Truth. They're still running that petition. It's growing. You don't have to be an architect or engineer even. There's 30,000 others supporting them. You could donate to richardgage911.org. That's what keeps me presenting around the country, presenting virtually in these webinars, presenting in interviews that we continue to do one or two per week. You can become a member, $10, $50, $100 a month. You can make a one-time donation here by PayPal. That you can become a member by clicking that button, become a member. And you can choose a subscription plan, $7 a month. That's a cup of coffee. With enough of you supporting the efforts that we do here together, we can continue doing it. Because I'm on my own now. And I need you to support me if you value what I'm doing. If you value it a lot, you're going to help us. Put in your own sweat equity along with Gail and I so that we can make things happen at a much bigger scale with you helping us. Maybe you're a website developer, podcasting technology, social media promotion, technical writing, foreign language translation, phone calls, radio and TV interviews. We need those. We need to outreach to them and invite them to interview us, especially on mainstream, which is particularly reluctant to embrace what they call conspiracy theories. Well, it's closing in on them, all kinds of conspiracy theories that are proving to be true. Video and audio editing. Maybe you know someone of influence that you can help us to reach. All of that and more. You can do things on your own. Contact your elected representatives, television, radio, newspaper. Tell everybody you know. Screen the DVDs that we have available for you. Share them. Download the 135-page evaluation by Leroy Halsey of World Trade Center 7, which completely pulled the rug out from World Trade Center 7's initiation collapse theory by NIST. Proving that NIST committed fraud, essentially, because fire did not cause the collapse of World Trade Center 7, as they found in their finite element analysis, which took 3 years, 4 years, and $300,000. World Trade Center 7 did not experience a progressive collapse, as claimed by NIST. It was actually a global collapse caused by the near simultaneous failure of all of its columns. That's documented in this film, which you can purchase over at AE911Truth. And there's a request for a correction, which you can do with agencies that commit fraud like NIST did in their final report, all of their reports. And this is challenged. And AE911Truth has sued them to get them to come clean with the fraud that they've committed. That's why I will go with you in a meeting that you initiate with your elected representative for 10 minutes on the phone. I'll give the presentation. You make the appointment, contact me through our website, and we'll make that happen. We've had probably 100 of such calls, and we just have to keep pounding. What we're going to ask them to do is submit the Bobby McElvain Act for a new World Trade Center investigation. And that is already written. All they have to do is in a select House or Senate committee is make it happen. The grand jury investigation, as I mentioned, is underway. We have a commitment to comply with the law, which is not being done by the U.S. attorney. And therefore, we're suing them through the auspices of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry, whom I am also partnering with to create a new film, 9/11 Crime Scene to Courtroom. This film will take all the evidence we've been putting together in this series, film it in a courtroom, talk into the grand jury. The film series will then be given as evidence submitted as a supplement for a special grand jury investigation. And that has to be shown to them as well. So it'll put you and the grand jurors in the seat of evaluating the evidence and those who we're recommending to the jurors to subpoena to get more information. Mick Harrison here is the chief spokesperson for that effort, and he'll be filmed with me in the courtroom. We're riding on the coattails also of the historic unanimous vote for a resolution by New York area town led by Christopher Gioia, fire commissioner, who says you better believe that when the entire fire service of New York is on board, we'll be an unstoppable force. And that's why we also have an effort in the UK to investigate, reinvestigate, open the inquest into the death of Jeff Campbell, an effort led by his brother, Matt. He was murdered in the 126th floor of the North Tower. A real inquest with this evidence is what is being evaluated right now in the legal system in London. Part of which is Beyond Misinformation, the 50-page booklet created by AE 911 Truth, an exceptional booklet which pulls the rug out from underneath the NIST report. We have taken 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, controlled demolition experts, all laying out this evidence in this one-hour documentary, which is free on YouTube, and there's an hour-and-a-half documentary available. Take a look.
I don't want to be involved in conspiracy theories. There are lots of them that can go on. We can speculate on that forever. What we really need to know is how those buildings came down.
World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives or from fuel oil fires.
To undermine scientific integrity is to undermine our democracy.
This is what NIST has done, denied and ignored crucial evidence.
The American people absolutely need the truth of 9/11.
More than 1,500 architects and engineers and 12,000 others, including many scientists, have signed the petition calling for a scientific investigation of the destruction of the Twin Towers and World Trade Center Building 7. The report, issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, referred to as NIST, was not valid science.
They're talking about a single columnar collapse or failure that resulted in a total collapse of the building.
Building number 7 descended in free fall for the first 100 feet, which means that there was absolutely no resistance to descent whatsoever.
So all of the columns really needed to be severed at the same time.
The symmetry is the smoking gun.
NIST has admitted it went into free fall for 8 stories.
And you don't need to be an engineer or an architect to see what happened to those buildings.
This is controlled demolition.
Shakevator.
What I saw, it was a classic implosion. The center of the core, the penthouse area, starts to move first, and then the building follows along with it.
NIST excluded the documents from FEMA in Appendix C that documented the evidence of melting steel.
In an office fire, you cannot generate enough heat to melt steel.
There were these iron microspheres present in all of the dust samples. They needed to have been formed in extremely high temperatures.
All the characteristics of the microspheres, along with what I see in the attack of the beams that were actually found, tell me that thermite was involved.
In the dust, what we have found is a modern version of thermite, which we call nanothermite.
NIST concedes that they found no evidence for explosives.
So then we asked them, well, did you look? And they said, no, we did not look for explosives or residues of explosives.
And in fact, the evidence is overwhelming that these red grade crystals are very high temperature incendiaries.
And we have watched as scientific integrity has been undermined and scientific research politicized in an effort to advance predetermined ideological agendas.
If this is a crime, I think everybody agrees it's a crime. Evidence was removed from the scene of the crime. You can't do science when you are deprived of the evidence and when your hypothesis is the least valid instead of the most likely. And the most likely hypothesis in the case of Building 7 wasn't even mentioned. This is not science.
And yes, you can have access to this free on YouTube. The 1.5 hour version you can buy over at AE911 Truth. That brings us to some questions. So let's go to Gail and see if we have some questions. Let's bring her back. There you are. Hello.
Hello, hello. I am back.
Yay. Whoops. We lost you again. We'll go there.
No, don't lose me.
So, tell us, Gail.
Yes.
What have we got for questions today?
Well, we have a few questions that you had mentioned earlier in the beginning of the webinar from Simon Thornycroft. The first question is,
good old Simon.
Richard, do you accept that the Cardington experiment was a good demonstration of what happened in an office fire? If not, will you explain why and point us in the direction of a better experiment?
We used the Cardington office fire as an example of what we might expect in a very hot fire, the hottest of fires that they could create in this 8-story building in 1995, which was a steel framed, fireproofed and partially unfireproofed building or steel members. What happened in that fire? The steel can warp when it gets that hot above 1200 degrees Fahrenheit. The connections don't fail. The building doesn't fall apart. There's no failure. So this is a very important precedent, which NIST mentioned, but didn't compare to the, for instance, Building 7, which also had steel beams that were affected by fire. NIST actually took off the fireproofing for some unknown reason. The fireproofing was there. Why not test it in the condition in which it was when the Building 7 caught on fire on 9/11? Presumably by the steel beams, as NIST speculates, and is maybe true. But so, yes, the Cardington fire is a very important example. And it proves that Building 7 never should have come down under any of those circumstances because it even had fireproofing, where the Cardington didn't. Cardington example. That's a city in the UK. So I'm not sure what a follow-up question to that might be, but you're welcome to submit that to Gail, Simon. Other questions, Gail?
Yes, yes. So the next one from Simon is, do you accept that if the controlled demolition hypothesis is either inconsistent with the facts or if it lacks internal consistency, that it is flawed?
What we showed in part one of this webinar, part two of this webinar series, and part three covering World Trade Center 7 and 1 and 2 is that the evidence is completely consistent with the hypothesis of explosive controlled demolition with incendiaries and high energy explosives. So I'm not sure why you're trying to suggest that it is not. Because if you were here today, listening at all, and if you've seen any of our presentations before, we clearly document that there is no other hypothesis that stands a chance, particularly the hypothesis of normal office fires in the case of Building 7 and in the case of the Twin Towers, a few broken columns by airplanes and normal office fires after the jet fuel burns up in just 10 minutes, according to NIST, it was gone. So we have normal office fires after that. So I don't know where you've been or what your specific question might be, which I'd like to hear. But the evidence is completely supports the hypothesis of explosive controlled demolition with incendiaries and high energy explosives.
Okay. And then there's one more from Simon. Richard, the firefighters who survived in the stairwell of the North Tower were present before, during, and after the collapse of the building, but reported no explosions. Please explain.
I don't know that that's true, that they didn't report explosions. They may have reported explosions, and you might not, and I might not, have heard it. There's 156 well-documented reports of explosions by firefighters before, many of them, before the towers ever came down. I don't know where you were 2 weeks ago when we talked about part two, but I highly encourage you to pull up free on YouTube 9/11 An Architect's Guide, part two, The Twin Towers Explosive Destruction, to learn that the extraordinary amount of evidence and eyewitness testimony supports explosives theory, including most all of the TV reporters on the site on that day. 36 of 40 reporters. We documented this in that webinar too. I don't know where you were there, but the TV reporters, 36 of 40 of them documented this as an explosion-based event. Many of them, 22 of them, personal witnesses, in addition to the firefighters, of explosions. You can't just wave that away. You can't just pretend that 156 first responders aren't on oral recordings whose transcripts are on the New York Times website, talking about the ground shaking before the towers ever came down, a train running under my feet, pop, 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 like when they bring down a controlled demolition. That's what I thought I saw. We went through all this 2 weeks ago. It's there. Why do you consistently deny the evidence that I've been, and many others, have been making so plainly available for you? Why don't you take Graham McQueen's essay, 2015, that documents one by one 156 first responders, and take them one by one and tell me how each one of them is not true? Because that's what you have to do if you're going to be an effective debunker. Otherwise, you're just crying in the wind, and nobody's going to pay attention to you. Let's get to the evidence. Next question.
All right. When you have Chinese junk haulers standing by for the exact amount of steel for three buildings, someone had to order those ships. Has anyone traced that part of 9/11?
That's an important piece of research that I have not seen done. It's been said that the amount of barges to be available within 2 weeks, for the hauling away of all this debris to China and India. It would have had to have been contracted well before 9/11. I don't have evidence for that. I think it's very, very important. I probably won't talk about it because I've got a 4.5-hour webinar series already. I have to condense it down to an hour and a half for many presentations and 45 minutes for most. So I really have to focus on what I find and my audience finds to be the most powerful pieces. But I'm glad at least in this webinar series, I have enough time in 4.5 hours over 3 separate presentations to give you a more comprehensive scope that you can actually present to others. But yeah, I'd love to see that research and more research on the ACE elevator modernization, the largest modernization in the world, which could have given access to the core columns and beams in the structure the 9 months prior to 9/11 when it was happening, presumably, possibly, hypothetically, under an operation, a black operation, an undercover operation to place these explosives in their various forms and incendiaries.
Okay. Here's the next question. Have there been any fire construction code changes to the account for the rigorous science that the government applied to figure out that office fires can bring down steel frame buildings?
They have a 20-year, a $20 million final report that's 10,000 pages. Part of it is recommendations for code changes, because after all, if these buildings came down by office fires at almost free fall acceleration within an hour, and Building 7 was free fall acceleration for a third of its 7-second fall, and there's many buildings that are similarly designed, isn't this a huge problem, the scale of which should necessarily require a complete reexamination of our existing buildings and the future ones, thus the codes we build the future ones by? So NIST tried to cover themselves by making a set of recommendations. But the only ones that have been incorporated were in the field of egress from the buildings, protecting stairway systems, making them wider, and adhesion of cementitious materials to the steel, the fireproofing, because it was said that the airplanes knocked off the fireproofing in the Twin Towers. But not one of their recommendations for structural changes, something that would keep a skyscraper from falling at free fall out of the sky after an hour of being on fire. They say Building 7 had 7 hours of fire, but there's only 20 minutes of fire around the beams that were alleged to have been expanded, pushing a girder off of its seat, causing floor 13 to fall on 12, and so on. No structural changes have been made to the International Building Code. In other words, they think their buildings are fine. Thank you very much. We're not going to change the codes. That's a complete slap in the face and an exposure of the fraud committed by NIST in even suggesting that these buildings came down by fire and therefore structural changes need to be made. They were completely ignored. And our buildings are fine. Guess what? Not one of them, even after 9/11, there's been a dozen severe fires in high-rise buildings, and not one of them has come down in these fireproof steel frame high-rises. Next question.
All right. What happened to the horseshoe beam? Has anyone seen it since that video?
I don't know what the disposition of that horseshoe-shaped beam was. It had like 6-inch thick steel slabs, and it was straight. And now it is bent in a horseshoe. And as the contractor said, it takes thousands of degrees to accomplish that. I want to know from the debunkers where the heat came from. You notice we didn't have any answers, any possible answers as to where all this heat came from, if it's not thermite, for which there's ample, irrefutable, and overwhelming evidence. Why don't you start addressing the real questions, Simon Thornycraft, instead of picking away at flies it's like you're picking it at the wrong weeds, but you're just picking at weeds, you're picking at straw, and you're not addressing the core of the evidence. So I appreciate you bringing your very weak questions and innuendos to the webinar today, but give me something that I can really work with. Give me a challenge. Give me something that, you know, give us all something that will allow us to respect where you're coming from, instead of wasting our time and looking really, really bad on your part. Next question.
Well, you did prompt a response from Simon, so would you like me to read it?
Let's do it.
Okay. I have read most of the oral histories of 9/11 that were gathered by the New York Fire Department and published in the New York Times, and found no expressions of surprise that Building 7 collapsed. And he has a question mark.
Well, hold on a second. Question. Hold on a second. There's a disconnect here. We'll get back to that. The oral histories that I heard, I mean, that Graham McQueen studied, were with respect to World Trade Center 1 and 2, the towers. The oral histories don't relate to Building 7, as far as I know. Maybe they do, and I'm just not aware of that. But there's a distinction there to be made. There's the evidence, the witnesses of explosions relative to Building 7 are in our webinar about Building 7, and we host three of them there, and they include Barry Jennings, they include Daryl, a medical student, who heard a loud explosion and then the building coming down. Barry Jennings describing explosions in the building before it came down, while he was in the building, blowing him around in the building. And then he came out and he presented this to the media. So it's very clear that there are witnesses of explosions, including the other gentleman, I can't remember his name. Well, there's Kevin McPadden also, who heard the ground shaking like a train running under my feet. He said he wanted to grab onto something. And then the building came down after he heard a countdown on the radio held in the hand of what he thought was a Red Cross worker. So that's key evidence. And then we heard the other gentleman who saw a flash of light before Building 7 came down. So there's four examples right there. In the case of Kevin McPadden, he's a former Air Force medic, and he was on duty. Well, he was there as a first responder. Go ahead, Gail. There's another part of that question.
All right. Another question. Whatever happened to Stephen Jones?
Well, wait. You didn't finish the second part of the first question there.
Oh, Oh, I read the whole entire thing, but I can go back and read it again.
Oh, did I thought I interrupted you. Did I or did I not?
No. No, you didn't.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so let me go back to the next question. Yes, what happened to Stephen Jones?
What happened? He's still doing his thing. It's just a different thing. He's in the South, I believe. He's retired, of course, from Brigham Young University, where he was a professor and he was a nuclear physicist. So, yeah, he's working on solar ovens and other things. We'd like to have him back on our podcast, Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. So I'll make a note and make that happen today.
That'd be awesome.
Anything else?
Yes. This is from Lynn Settle. He's a friend of ours. He says, based on overwhelming evidence, when most reasonable people agree that the government 9/11 narratives are ridiculous, as pointed out in your presentation, they've lied repeatedly. Can we expect former government employees coming forward to share critical information exposing this internal cover-up, or is the hidden government that fearsome?
I don't know how fearsome the hidden government is with their bribery and blackmail operations. I mean, if you know something about this project and you come out, you're likely to be killed. Nevertheless, there are people, insiders, who are doing that, and they're available. Susan Lindauer was on our podcast. She's an example in that category. A very, very brave example, given that she was arrested and tortured by the CIA. Excuse me, that's a misnomer, and I keep repeating it. She was not tortured. Somebody said that about her, and it kept into my brain. Anyway, I hope that we get insiders coming out. Lynn, I'm just, maybe we should put an invitation on our website. I just don't know how to protect them. I mean, really, I'm just an architect. Okay. I don't know how to run an operation like that. I'd love to have the information, though. I don't want the responsibility of giving that information out, giving their name, and having them be disappeared or something. Philip Marshall was a researcher of 9/11. They killed him. They killed his kids. They killed his dog, and they blamed it on suicide. This was not a suicidal person. And that's what happens to some people. He wrote the book Bamboozled. That was the main part of the book name. I can't remember the rest of it. So he had information about how the planes were used. He had investigated the secret airports of the CIA in Arizona. And I guess he got too far into that. Very, very tragic.
Okay. Next question is an observation and then a question. I think in today's age, most people know. The question is, what can we do about it? I'm assuming most people know about 9/11 and that it was a false flag, but what can we do about it?
Well, what we have to do is open our mouths. Let's just assume we're members of the public, right? I mean, we don't have any special inside information. Therefore, we don't have the risk, other than being called a conspiracy theorist. If you can take the heat of that, you can make a big difference in the world by telling three or four people. I mean, what if everybody who, and there's millions who have heard this webinar series, particularly when I was with AE 9/11 Truth and I had the platform to reach that many people. And on our radio interviews, I've reached many, many millions of people, and I still have that opportunity. You can call your local radio station and say, hey, there's 3,500 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation of the destruction of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. Richard Gage is the chief and foremost speaker on this subject. Why don't you ask him to be on your program? Now, if you guys did that, you'd be doing something that could make a difference in the world. If you give somebody a brochure, you could be doing something that can make a difference in the world. If you pass the link to this webinar to five architects and six structural engineers in your community, you'll be making a difference in the world. If you do nothing, you won't be able to look your grandchildren in the eye. So make your choice and let it be guided by your conscience. That's what's driven me for 15 years now, and that's what drives Gail. We're working together like a team now. We're bringing guests in and around the 9/11 truth movement. We're taking risks and bringing people to talk about the disease that's going around and the false solution to it. If I can take risks like this, surely you can. Join the right side of history. Do something productive that's going to change the world. Don't just whine in the background. And for God's sake, don't obstruct our efforts to get a real investigation. Gail?
Okay. Why didn't we bomb Saudi Arabia since most of the hijackers were from there? The quotes are in the question.
Okay. Well, I think most of you know the answer to this question. We have a very tight, cozy relationship with Saudi Arabia. This is where a lot of our oil comes from. That is who supports the U.S. economy and the petrodollar. They own a huge percentage of our debt. We're not going to be pursuing justice in a false flag operation that the Saudis know full well about, who could turn around and spill the beans. So I could speculate endlessly on that question.
Okay. Next question. What do you think is the end game with the oligarchy that is orchestrating all of these horrible events?
Okay. So I'm an architect and I'm invited to step beyond my technical credibility more often than you can imagine. And this is a huge opportunity to do just that in a amplified way times 100. But I think it's also incumbent upon me not to hide behind the limits of my technical expertise with buildings, and which is why we're bringing in and connecting dots to other conspiracies, which prove to be factual. So where, if there are other conspiracies, then are the same people running them? I.e. the bankers, the people who run the world, the people who run the bankers. I've done research in these areas, and I think it's not hard to find the answers to these types of questions. But I think that Gail and I have a primary responsibility to the base of supporters that we represent to keep our credibility intact by not speculating. But I encourage you to Google who runs the world. you know. And let us know what you find. Because we may have guests that are willing to speculate on that. But I'm not. Gail?
Yep. No, me neither. You ready for the next question?
I think so.
Okay. Hi, RNG. That's us, RNG. I have several friends who are not dullards, but who get very upset and insulting towards me when I bring up 9/11. How do you all deal with these harsh reactions from friends and family?
It's tough. Gail, why don't you take that particular question on personally?
Well, I can't give any examples because I am fortunate enough that all my family that I interact with, all my friends and past coworkers that I interact with are all on the same page and they're all awake about 9/11. So
are you serious?
I personally have never, ever had to deal with anyone in my personal life rejecting my beliefs about 9/11 or really any conspiracy theories. So you're going to have to take that one.
That's very interesting. You're very fortunate, by the way. This is the minority. I have had my own family members and friends not believe me, think I'm nuts. These are people who will not even look at the evidence, by the way. I think that's really important. It's not like they said, well, let me see your evidence and then I'll evaluate. No. I gave the DVD that I made like, I don't know, 10 years ago almost to my uncle. And he looked at it and the strangest look came over him and his body and he kind of tightened up. He put it down. He didn't ask any questions. And he didn't know what to say. He was in fear. And he never looked at it. This is my uncle who's very proud of me otherwise, you know, as an architect. He can't bring himself to imagine that such a power exists in our country and around the world, controlling the media to the extent that not a whiff of 9/11 truth gets out through the mainstream media, which, by the way, is owned by five corporations, which is run by the same people who run the corporations in the arms industry, the oil industry, the banking industry, the insurance industry, all of whom profited enormously from 9/11. But without knowing that, without understanding through the case studies of false flag operations like 9/11, this being new to people forces them into a complete confrontation with their own reality, their inner reality. Their frame of reference is not capable of handling the cognitive dissonance, which is huge, which forces us into a massive state of fear when we're confronted with something which contradicts our own reality, i.e. the world is safe, i.e. my government is here for me, i.e. my representatives are for the most part doing what I'm paying them to do in Congress. Once you start just opening your eyes, doing a little bit of research, like 9/11 as a case study, for instance, that reality gets shattered. And I remember in 2006, when my reality was shattered, when I heard on the radio David Ray Griffin going over some of the evidence that we've been going over today and 2 weeks ago, my reality just started coming apart. I started, you know, I was like hurting inside. At first, I got, this can't be true. He's lying. This is an elderly gentleman who didn't sound like he was lying. So I investigated further. And as I investigated further and found out by talking to people who were willing to confront the facts around the truth about 9/11, piece by piece, the false structure of the reality that I had intact about how the world runs and my relationship to my government and the media, seeing the vast manipulation across the country and around the world fall. The structure fell, and I just began to get real angry. I mean, really angry. I drew a line in the sand, you know, right there. There's a particular moment that happened a day later or so, because David Ray Griffin was presenting at the Grand Lake Theater. He had 600 people packed. I went the next day. I couldn't get in. It was sold out. I had to go home and watch on live stream. I just got really, really angry. You're not going to pull this over on me. I'm an architect. These are buildings. I didn't have an excuse. I don't know where the other architects were, but they weren't organized. There was no architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. So I had to do something. So when you're confronted with the inability of people to come to that realization, and it's more often than not, I think, with people on the street, for instance, people you meet on the street, you're just planting a seed. You have to let them go. Say, well, just look at it. Give them a DVD. Give them a brochure. Look at it when you get a minute. Be soft. Be kind. Be gentle. Be loving. No reason to bash anybody over the head like a 2x4 with a 2x4, because that's what this information is capable of doing. And you don't want to be the asshole. It's just not effective. You might be an asshole, and that might be fine for you. I'm just saying it's not effective with others. I've actually tried it. It doesn't work. So I hope you have better luck with some of these ideas. What do you think, Gail?
I completely agree. In fact, I was just thinking while you're giving your answer, that even though I haven't had to deal personally with people in my life rejecting what I know about 9/11 Truth, I can definitely imagine how I would handle it if anyone did. And it is very much the same as how you just described handling it. But above all, you've got to do everything you do in love, with love and compassion and understanding that they're just not in that place of understanding at the moment, and you need to gently help them. So yes,
right.
That was a great answer.
Why don't we end on that answer?
Okay. Yes. It is 2:30.
We're going on too long, and that's a good place to end.
Yes.
So any final thoughts, Gail?
No, I think that was great. There's a lot of awesome comments, and there was more questions, but you know, if any of the questions didn't get answered, you guys are welcome to email us. And one of the questions was if we received an email from someone, and if you emailed us and you did not get a response, we wholeheartedly apologize for that. We do get a lot of emails daily and other forms of communication between people. So we're trying to keep up, but I will definitely go back and check and see if we got that email, and then we will answer it. So
beautiful.
Go ahead and ask the questions on our website if you'd like, and we'll answer you as soon as we can.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, what we've been looking at today is the high-rise fires, the pyroclastic-like clouds, molten steel and iron evidence, iron microspheres, thermite, nanothermite, all of which is apparently still denied, even though some have looked at this evidence with us today, and it is overwhelming, irrefutable. So I don't know what I can do to help some people, but I'm going to let them go lovingly. I'm not going to call them names like I did earlier. I apologize. I can do that when I get out of hand.
Just a little quick note too, just to remind everyone, there will not be a webinar next week because this is part three. And so we take a week off before we pick up part one again.
In May, the first Thursday of the month, Wednesday. And the first Wednesday, we start over again with part one of the series.
May 7th.
Is World Trade Center Building 7. Yeah. And that is will be on the first Wednesday in May. So
May 7th, yes.
We'll see you guys then. I'm looking forward to bringing this information to you.
Bye.
Don't be the last to know. That's what you need to keep in your mind. You know, do you want your friends to come back and say, well, you never told me, you know, your colleagues, your workers? Don't be the last to know. We have picked up the torch and we're going to not stop until the explosive destruction of these three towers has been thoroughly investigated in an unimpeachable investigation. We're not going to give up, and we hope you'll stay the course with us and join us. By the way, click on become a member and see how you can help us. Thanks so much. Bye for now.
Bye.